Let's start out this week with a couple of corrections. Not necessarily corrections, but just maybe learning some more information since last week. The first is, I was telling you last week about how there's this cool thing on the iPhone 11, you know, model phones, where you can use the new quick capture feature to record video quickly, but also with audio playing in the background from your phone without cutting off that audio. If it's pertinent to the video, it can be included. That's all correct. The part that, we didn't know about, but we said kind of question mark here is, are there any, is there any difference in that video quality and what you capture the old way of going to the video tab and hitting record? You know, having a week to inspect this and see, it seems like, yes, the videos are limited in a pretty big way if specs are what you're concerned about. Like, it's not 4K at 60 frames per second. It's 1080p at 30 frames per second, regardless of what your settings are.
Yeah, and that's for quick take on the lock screen or if you're actually inside the camera app.
Yep, and that part, I suppose, makes sense that they're able to fire that up faster than they can the video camera. I mean, we mentioned how there's a sort of a lengthy delay whenever you go to video and hit record, or just to go to video and like let it load in.
Yeah, the mode, yeah. The dedicated mode.
So maybe that's what it is that just processor-wise and everything.
What you probably find is, you know, the viewfinder preview? Mm-hmm. That might be 1080p already, so they just start streaming that to disk. Whereas if you actually switch to the video setting, then they're having to load up the 4K, you know, stream that's independent.
It doesn't feel as bad to me as like whenever I think it was the iPhone 5, they put the shutter button in video, and I think that's just like a screenshot of the video, basically. Like, not a... It's not like the same as if you had taken a photo when you're not recording a video. And so this feels like it's not that bad, where it isn't just like a screen recording of the viewfinder. It is, I guess, 4:3 ratio. And so that does make sense. That is, it's taking that and making it a video. But it's not a huge concession to me, especially, you know, the quick capture kind of suggests this is not, you know, you're setting up to like record someone walking down the aisle, but you know, it's a photo that turned into a video.
Yeah, it's like you're in the middle of snapping pictures and you just want to capture the moment a bit better. So you just hold the button down and you take a video.
Yes, and I've already got my camera roll being filled up with videos when my 2-year-old son is holding the camera and holding down the button. And he's... 2-year-old, I mean, kids are so smart. He sees that it's doing a video, and so he interacts with that. But he also remembers the old way that it was a burst mode of a bunch of pictures that he could like cheese out with. And now he just taps the button. He doesn't know the gesture, of course, to like do burst mode and like, you know, the old way. But he still wants a bunch of pictures taken. So he's just like tapping and tapping and tapping, then doing some video, and then tapping and tapping again. And I can't bring myself to delete any of these.
You need to teach him how to do burst mode new.
I know, yeah. And then some more information about picture-in-picture on the Apple TV. This is something that had changed in the betas to the release, and so there's some new information there to share, right?
Yeah, this is a sad correction, because last week we were talking about picture-in-picture on tvOS, and I said, yes, it does work in any application like you would do on the iPhone and the iPad, where you're playing the video, you can press the home button and then go browse, you know, the home screen in any other app. Well, that is how it worked during the beta period, but clearly in the very late seeds and then through to public release, they've changed it. So now the picture-in-picture that you can invoke from within the TV app, the picture-in-picture doesn't leave the TV app. So if you try and press TV, it just switches to the picture-in-picture window and you can close it or move it around. You can't go back to the home screen or browse anywhere else. So it's a bit of a bummer because it limits the utility of the picture-in-picture feature quite a lot, because I don't spend, you know, my entire life using the Apple TV in the TV app, and I use a lot of like Plex stuff, and you can't mix and match anymore like you could in the beta period, which is sad. And there's no third-party API for picture-in-picture yet, so it's quite limited in its current form being TV app only.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, picture-in-picture seems like such a, you know, I heard some people say like, what is it for? What's the point of this? It's way better on the Mac and iOS, but you know, I mean, the phrase comes from TVs. It's like a built-in TV feature. And so it feels like it's such a gimme feature on the TV. But when it's limited to one app, that was not really the case for, you know, old-fashioned TV world. So it feels like it needs some more attention to be sort of what it needs to live up to be. So
yeah, and clearly because it hasn't been blessed with an API, where because all of, you know, on the Mac and on iOS, that it has a proper API for third parties to use, mm-hmm. because it hasn't happened on the TV yet, it seems like they're just kind of, you know, experimenting a little bit, and then mm-hmm. they'll probably finalize it in a future update and make it go, you know, across every app again. Kind of like the multiple account stuff like we were talking about last week, the multiple account stuff seems very motivated by, you know, the imminent launch of TV Plus, and the picture-in-picture probably benefits TV Plus a bit, so they've kind of put it in there, even if it's not a fully formed feature yet.
Speaking of multiple accounts, I don't think I'm going to be able to convince anyone in my house to use that, to change the profile, that they'll always just use the last profile, and for
that's
that reason...
In.
Yeah. So,
yeah, they kind of need a setting where when you go to the home screen, it shows you like a user switch on the screen.
Yeah.
Because otherwise you forget to go to the, like, hold down the TV button and open the side, you know, open control center and switch it from there. They need like a big visual indicator when you're on Springboard to be like, you're logged in as this person. And when you're inside Music, it has the little like profile picture, so you do know like what account you're currently on.
Uh-huh.
But it's not enough for, you know, it's not enough for like a kid or anyone in the family really to really pay attention to it enough. Like mm-hmm. Netflix, when you launch Netflix, every single time it comes up with that user account screen, right? And it says you're logged in as this person. It'd be nice if the integrated TV multiple account thing could do something like that. Like every time you launch, like if you launch the TV app after, you know, 30 minutes of inactivity, it shows you which account do you want to use, for instance, because they need the little like prompt reminders, or even like a little thing in the top right corner which just says which account, you know, says the name of the current logged in user, because otherwise, you know, normal people in the family aren't going to remember to switch around and change account.
Yeah, I totally see how it's a tricky problem to solve, because in Hulu I have account set up for everyone in the family, or I did, and you know, the threshold there, even if it's, well, you know, 30 minutes, that's pretty good. But just going back at, like, every day, turning on the TV and then launching the Hulu app and then picking the profile, I decided I'm just going to have me. And the kids can use me. My wife can use me. Like, it doesn't matter. We'll all just use one profile and not even have, like, multiple profiles, because I was the only one changing the person, I think. And then it was just one more button click, and so for me it wasn't worth it. But it there must be a middle ground, which for me would be you always see on the home screen or the TV app, at, you know, at least where you are visually. And this is a problem that anything with user accounts has to deal with, you know, some way of showing who's logged in, whether it's just your name or a photo or something. So
yeah, almost if they were doing it even better, they could, in the TV app, obviously it controls the up next queue, so it'd be nice if you could just see like the up next queue of everyone in your family on on that main page, so you wouldn't have to like switch accounts. You could just go up in the rows and pick a different row that says like, this is Zach's up next, this is, you know, Benjamin's up next, this is the kids up next, and you could literally just flick through it like that.
So that'd be pretty
cool. At once.
Yeah,
but
I like
that's not how it works.
And they do have sort of a design solution to, like, you know, if they wanted to, how they put faces over like album art on Apple Music sharing. You know, so they've already got that solved. that's a good direction though. I like that idea.
Yeah.
I want to talk a bit about the iPad 7. So this is the iPad that was introduced next to the iPhone 11 at the September Apple event. And so it's just called iPad. It's the seventh generation. That is the 10.2-inch model with 32 gigabytes and a $329 starting price that replaced the 9.7-inch iPad. I think what it picked up was the smart connector, the bigger screen, and no new processor, nothing new with the screen. Could already work with Apple Pencil, can work with the Crayon, first generation Pencil, of course. But I wasn't super interested in this. We had the iPad 6 in the house, which was the second $329 iPad. There was the iPad 5 before that. Wasn't that the first at that price point?
I think that's right.
Yeah. So we had the 6 one, and I actually had it in like the Logitech, I don't even know the name of the case, but it was the one that was education only, where it was like really industrial looking, like way more than OtterBox and
really boxy.
Yeah. And I mentioned this show like that. I think that combination will be my daughter's like first computer, because it's got the keyboard. It's, you know, it can stand up. It's got, you know, Pencil input or Crayon input. And that worked for a while. But the problem was that the case was just so, like rickety that she dropped it naturally because it's a big heavy thing, and the screen cracked on it with that case on there. You know, as ugly as it was, it didn't do a good job of protecting it, and so then the screen was damaged. But it was just like a tiny little hairline crack. It wasn't a very big deal. It barely touched the screen. It was from like the bottom corner. But then I do what I do as dad, and I take it out of the case to clean it. And the process of removing it and putting it back in the case, I think, required pressure. And so that crack got way worse. And then we had several weeks where we had to put the iPad in the closet because it wasn't safe to touch. I just thought if I even move it, like, the screen will start to fall off of this thing. So we had to retire that iPad way too soon. I think that happened before the new one was announced, maybe even. And but then it was in a Best Buy, and I thought, I wonder if they have the new ones in the store in stock, and they did. And so we bought one of those for my daughter. It was a huge surprise to her because she didn't know those new ones existed. She appreciated it. This was bigger in terms of the screen. You know, it's like what, half an inch larger diagonally. So, you know, everything's a bit bigger. Still works with her Crayon, works with the Apple Pencil, first generation. And that's all nice. But the thing that I've found interesting about it that I guess wasn't part of the keynote was, you know, this is kind of they call it their most popular iPad model, but accessories for it are hard to come by. And they're just not quite there yet because it is a new random size. You get some luck out of the fact that like the Smart Keyboard from Apple works with it because it's made for the 10.5 inch iPad Pro and Air.
Yeah, because it's basically a 10.5 inch chassis just with a 10.2 inch screen inside it.
Yeah, just more bezel. And that seems to be why they did this at all. And so she asked me about the keyboard situation, and she uses Chromebooks in first grade. And she said, I still want a Chromebook though. I'm like, no, you don't. You have those at school. She's asking like, for Christmas, can I get a laptop or a Chromebook? And I'm like, well, you've got this.
You need to tell her about the iPad OS desktop class browsing.
Yeah, I know. I'm like, no, your iPad can do that. Her mom uses an iPad Pro as a laptop replacement with a bridge keyboard and like split screen apps. And I'm like, no, you can really do this as a laptop, you know, especially with what you need. And so we ordered the Smart keyboard, which is the cover, right? And so that one, I was thinking like, is this going to work with the case that we have for it? But then it does, because it's not the back cover, it's not the folio, it's just the old way, it's the old keyboard where it's the part of the cover. And so we're using it with that, which makes it also, you know, stand up for like, you know, like TV mode kind of thing. And then the back case that we had for it, even before the Smart keyboard, is the one that Apple sells in their stores. We had to go to the store to find it. It's OtterBox Symmetry, but it's made for this specific generation. And it's cool. It's basically like if Apple made a clear case for the iPad, but it's from OtterBox. It's, you know, just sits in there. It's got a little like rubber band sort of attachment on the side that you can't remove, and that's made for the Apple Pencil, but it also works for holding the Logitech Crayon, which is like the Pencil Lite. And you can see the back of the iPad because it's a clear case. You can optionally attach this little slot on the side of it to just have full coverage on the side. Do you remember Apple silicon cover for the, or like case for the iPad Pro 9.7?
Yes.
And it had that gap because they wanted you to use it with a Smart cover or a keyboard, and you couldn't fill it in if you didn't want one of those two things.
Yeah, it was like a jigsaw piece, which the other the keyboard completed the other side of it.
Indeed. Well, yeah. This OtterBox Symmetry case makes no assumptions, and so it includes that as a separate piece. And so for the first few days, we were just using it with that, and I didn't even think about why is this not part of this case. But then when we got the Smart keyboard, I'm like, oh yeah, now we can access the Smart connector on this iPad, and then it fills in the gap. So I'm really happy with this combination. We also put on like one of those glass screen protectors so that no part of the iPad is exposed, really, and those have come in handy before for us, so... So that's our iPad 7 is decked out, and I went through, and I love going through like dad mode and just like looking at the state of the apps that are on her device, like where they're arranged, what's prioritized, kind of making some folders and things. And I did what I've been wanting to do for a while, which is look at all the games that are like ad-based, in-app-purchase heavy spam, you know, the kind that make her Safari full of all the links that they put in the ads. And I got rid of them. And I went through and looked at settings, general storage and usage. And then you can see the apps ranked by size to clear up space, but also when the app was last used. And so if there was an app that was especially spammy and it hasn't been used since July, then I had no question about getting rid of it. And there were like three apps that made the cut that she likes to use, but weren't ad free or in app purchase free. And I just put those in a folder so they're like less promoted. And then I went through Arcade and I found all the games that she's been playing on her iPod Touch. And I made sure that they were on the iPad as like first level, what you see kind of stuff. And, I have to say, like, she's really enjoyed this, and we'll talk about Arcade a little bit more in a bit. But, I also had the old Still Series Apple TV remote controller that has like a lightning port for charging.
Mm-hmm.
And, I made that her dedicated controller. And, now she's got this computer again that can do educational things. But also attach from the keyboard and prop up against something or have it stand up in the keyboard case or keyboard cover. And then you've got like a dedicated little console. So
that's
true. Yeah. It's something I didn't care about is now something that, I care a lot about. And then the old iPad is like slightly cracked, you know, I'm going to put a glass cover over that and then just use it for testing, you know,
kind of. Yeah. We're getting a iPad 7 in the family for Christmas. I'm assigned to buy it for someone in the family, but yes. We just because it's a Christmas present, you might as well wait to see if there's some, you know, up to holiday deals anyway. And
sure.
It's already like 10% off somewhere, so maybe by November we'll pick one of those up for Christmas, which would be very, very nice because it will be replacing a iPad Air, which unfortunately can't get iOS 13, so it can't get Arcade at all at the moment, and the iPad Air is cracked as well. So it'd be quite a nice bump up on that basis. This week, Happy Hour is sponsored by Totally. We're big fans of the branding-free Totally iPhone cases. They let you enjoy the design of the phone like it was meant to be, whilst adding some much-needed protection. Totally now offers quality, low-profile cases for the new iPhone 11, iPhone 11 Pro, and iPhone 11 Pro Max. Keep your phone protected without adding extra bulk or heft. The cases include a slight lip around the camera bump to further protect the essential lenses. The Totally cases are just 0.02 inches thin and as light as 0.1 ounces. It's almost like it's as close as you can get to having no case at all. Totally's cases are totally branding free. No logos on the front, back, sides, anywhere. The branding free approach is well suited to their range of clear cases, available for iPhone 11 and older iPhone 10 series. No branding, no bulk, no nonsense. But they don't just make clear cases. The branding-free philosophy spreads across their entire collection. They have black leather cases and matte colour options too. You can find all of these cases, screen protectors and more at totallycase.com. All of its cases include a 2-year warranty for peace of mind. They're all great prices and you can get an extra 25% off all Totally cases using promo code HAPPYHOUR. Go to totallycase.com and use promo code HAPPYHOUR. That's spelled TOTALLEECASE.com and use promo code HAPPYHOUR when you buy. Thanks to Totally Case for sponsoring the show.
All right, Mayo, I want to talk a couple of things about the iPhone situation, including...
You haven't bought a new one yet.
Well, hang on. I'm setting this all up for you.
Oh, here we go.
You know, like the state of dual cam apps, because I think when we last talked about this, it was like, you know, there's Filmic Pro coming, but I don't know if that update is even out yet. And there's some really it was weird. And there's some really bad ones out there that make your phone melt. But then in the past week, there's been a couple of really good ones. And then also want to discuss dark mode a little bit and then the swipe keyboard once more. But I'll set it up by saying that I mentioned we had to go into the Apple store to find that case for the iPad after we had the iPad. And it happened to be – I was listening to Will Sigmund on Twitter. He does a podcast called the Slice Podcast. with some friends of his, and I was listening to that podcast over on Saturday, and it was heavy on the iPad 11 Pro camera. And that morning I went out to the beach and I was like taking pictures at ultra wide and then the wide camera. And some of the stuff was kind of far away. And, and later that day, Jeff Benjamin and 9to5 Mac published his like 20-minute look at the iPhone 11 Pro. He'd already done the 11 video. And, I was like, you know, I'm going to the Apple store later. Maybe I should just put my iPhone 11 box in my backpack just in case. You know,
you're mentally readying yourself.
Yeah, just in case. And my wife was like, she had to grab something out of my backpack, and she was like, "What's this box doing in here? Are you getting a different phone?" And I was like, "I don't know. I don't even know what they have right now." we went to New Orleans for my birthday weekend and to have dinner in the city, and went to the store just to buy that case. And I looked online, and they had stock. And,
one thing led to another.
Yeah. And as, yeah, made the trade.
So what have you got? You got 11 Pro non-max or max?
Non-max.
Okay. Non-max. Okay. That's the good. That's what I was hoping you were going to say. Cause we went through this rigmarole last year where you got the max, then you realized it was too big. So at least you've skipped one layer of indirection.
It hurts to say this. I mean, just, you know, but whatever. I haven't told you this even, you know, since Saturday. So this is.
I know. This is the thing with this podcast now. Because it's become such a thing that you upgrade your device, you don't tell me anymore. So now it's genuine surprise every single time.
Did you see that tweet I did the day where it's like I found the fix for the accidentally deleting your email and the new mail app on iOS 13? Put black tape over the trash can. I had to do that on my wife's phone because I couldn't take a picture of my phone without you noticing.
I was gonna say that didn't look different.
Yeah, hers is the purple one, mine was green. I still recommend the iPhone 11 for everybody unless you have a reason to go with the Pro.
I do want to stress that, like, yes. We said this last week as well. Mm-hmm. But it's like the iPhone 11 $699 or the $751 for the storage upgrade,
yes,
is 100% better value for money for almost everybody. Mm-hmm. The differences including between the 11 and the Pro are very, very small. But, you know, if we're tech journalists, if we're doing, you know, if we write for an Apple blog, the money equation is a bit different. But
well, I will say if you care about mobile photography, then that's especially. I mean, you get a lot of the stuff in the 11, but just the 2x lens. There are shots that you can see with your eye that your phone can't capture, and maybe you have a camera, like I have a camera, but it's not with you, and you just get disappointed at how many things are far off that you can't. You see it in your head, but you can't capture it in the camera. And that can be like if you're a parent, you know, or if you have an animal and you want to like get those cute shots without getting real close up, you know, in a pinch. Honestly, like the LCD versus OLED thing, I was really happy with LCD. Dark mode, it was only at an angle where dark mode looked like it was like a blue light, not black. I was really impressed with the level, I guess the you know, contrast ratio that they were able to achieve with LCD. That was not a problem for me. The lack of OLED smearing on the LCD screen, I really enjoyed that. And going back to OLED, I started noticing it on the watch when I wasn't using OLED on the phone. I would, you know, scroll a list in like settings, for example, and I'd see it on the watch. And I was like, I hope they get around this one day. But now,
And you were somebody who I talk about OLED smearing all the time, and it didn't affect you as much before, right?
Correct.
But yeah, now you've got accustomed to the joys of the LCD,
uh-huh,
which doesn't have blue shift and it doesn't have smearing. And then you come back to the OLED and you're like, oh yeah, the screen is better for contrast, but it's not better in other ways.
That is right. And then, you know, I mentioned last week, next year we expect all phones to be OLED. So I think we all just have to get used to it or don't use dark mode. But yeah. And then the main reason was not, it wasn't, you know, the screen at all. That was kind of a setback in some ways. Although it is nice and like, you know, a black room, lights are all off, the screen's at its lowest dim level, and only the parts of the screen are lighting up in dark mode that are active. So that's a cool thing.
Yeah, I do think on balance, the OLED screen is nicer than the LCD, but it's not $400 worth of difference.
Yeah, we've been saying this for 3 weeks now, so it's
yeah.
We both agree on that. The camera difference, it's hard to justify, but it's just if you want that, then that's where you have to go, because you can't do optical, you know, 2x optical on the 11. And
Have you kind of weaned off the ultra wide shots now that the like gimmick's a bit older? If you know what I mean, you've had it for a little while.
I'm getting better at knowing what I like, which one to use. Yeah,
Fair enough.
Because if you just, there's a reason that you get options, you know, that it's not just one. Because certain shots are better for certain things, and so a lot of times now what I'm doing is, you know, wide by default, that's the first camera that you see. Take a shot in that. If it's not what I thought I wanted to capture, you know, you can even see it in the viewfinder, then change the camera. And a lot of times, like with ultra wide, if I want to get the camera, the photo I thought I wanted, then I'll still need to kind of get closer to it, because it'll make it where the subject isn't enough of filling up the screen. So I'll do ultra wide, get closer, and then that'll work well for me. But I am having fun still with doing that thing where you do one shot of each with each camera from the same perspective. I think it's just a cool effect. And that's part of what won me over too, was like the advertising from Apple on Instagram with like commissioned photographers, where they show really cool scenes. It's like you zoom back a step, you see more of the environment, you zoom way back, and it wasn't even what you thought it was. It's like a prop set in the middle of nowhere or something. It's all about 2x. I struggled enough with justifying the costs in my head without feeling terrible, so that I didn't do the thing that I probably ought to do, which is get 256 storage. I'm at 64. My rationale there is that I use iCloud Photo Library and then Apple Music with streaming and podcast streaming, audiobook streaming, like those. And I'm not doing gaming on the iPhone. I'm doing that on the iPad and the Mac now. I think it's okay, but from doing the backup and restore from another phone, it's not going well. My music, I've got zero songs right now, even though it's stuck on like syncing your library.
Oh dear.
Yeah. And my photos, they're all there, but they say managed storage, unable to update. And so I'm not sure what's happening there. So downgrading storage is a big deal. I'll just say that.
The photos are probably getting line eventually. It's just the classic iCloud photo situation where it's like eventually consistent, but it's not very quick about it. Like yes. Even my 11 Pro, when I set it up from new, I spent like, it did 50% of my photo library in one day, and then it took like another week and a half to do the remaining, you know, 10,000 pictures.
Yeah.
It's just a weird, iCloud Photos does some weird stuff. It gets there eventually. It's just a bit slow about it.
Yeah. And maybe it's worked out now, because I'm looking at it and it says last updated 10 minutes ago instead of managed storage. And that's 30,404 photos and then 2,682 videos, all possible because of the, you know, optimized storage feature.
And I think they've actually got better, by the way, with the optimized storage, if it actually optimizing more than before. Like the size of the photo library now seems to be smaller than ever before, which is a good step in the right direction.
Yeah, I do see things where I took a picture, you know, in the last 20 pictures, maybe in the last 10 pictures, and then I go to share them and they need to load in because it's aggressively making space. Storage wise, I've got something in files that seems to be local, 20 gigabytes. I'm not sure what it is, but I need to go hunt it down because I don't need that on my phone, whatever it is. I'm not sure what that is, but anyway, yeah. And space gray, you know, I had the option of all the colors, including the midnight green color, which I think is neater in person than I think online, but not for me, you know. And I went boring. I did space gray like you, and I was thinking about doing the orange case. It's got one other name too, but it's like in parentheses is orange, but it was not as vibrant in person as it was online. It was a little bit lighter, so I went with red.
Right. So we actually have the same phone for it's. Like, I think that's like a first for a long while.
But you have leather. I don't have the leather case. I've got the.
Yeah. But I mean the actual like device.
Okay.
Yeah. We were out of sync for a while because I had the 10, and then the 10, it was like, you know, and then you went to the Max, and I was like, you don't need the Max, you can get the 5.8 inch one. But now we've both calibrated on the best phone, unquestionably. Yeah.
So anyone that had bets out for how long it would take, if your guess was 15 days, which is one day over the return date, then you were correct. And
I think my guess was 0 days, so you beat my average.
Yeah, and there were a few people on Twitter who would and Instagram who would say, like, is this shot with the iPhone 11? Because people are saying 11 when they mean Pro, even though it's the same. I'd like to know. And my answer was always, yeah, it's the 11. It's not the Pro. And then there was even one person who said, like, you know, good job to you for actually like taking the advice that you give to people, which is, you know, you recommend the 11, you get the 11. And to that situation, I that was in my mind as I was exchanging it. But again, I can't say, like, don't get the pro if you're not a tech blogger. You know, my thought there is it depends on how much you use the camera and, like...
Yeah, but it's so much more money for one extra lens. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, that's the problem.
It's not a value, that's for sure.
No, exactly. That's the thing. Like, it's completely out of whack on value terms. If you need the feature, then that's different. But it's not, like, value for money at all. Right? That's the way you got to see it.
Yeah, that's true. But, you know, it's kind of like, what's the entry storage in the new Mac Pro? Do we know that yet?
256 gigabytes.
Yeah.
The Pro tier storage.
Yeah.
Which makes no sense because the iMac Pro starts at a terabyte, but the Mac Pro starts at 256.
Yeah, yeah. It kind of reminds me of that, though, how, like, you know, you have nicer specs in some areas and other specs just like, you know, you can't get to that 128. You've got to go to 256 for $150 more. And 64 gigabytes is probably too low for Pro. But then you say, well, if you got that many pictures that you know, might not even fit on 512, then you can offload them with our you know, cloud service. And same for music. So I can kind of, you know, you often see things that are that are like one thing nicer, but they're priced, I guess, to make up the difference of people, you know, making it worth doing in the first place. So I don't know, but this is where I am. I have to say, I was a really helpful person at the Apple Store in Metairie, Lakeside Shopping Mall, who helped me. And her name was Emma, and I remember because she would say, "My name is Emma. If I get lost, my name is Emma." You know, kind of thing. Like, you know, if we get separated. But anyway, it was one day over the return date, which I hadn't even considered. And, but they made it happen. And I was like, well, I'm giving you more money. You know, I've got all my stuff here. Is that okay? And you know, they made it happen. So I've got it.
Dual camera apps.
Dual camera apps. Yeah. So there are two that we like a lot. Filmic isn't out, as you mentioned, which is really weird because it was part of the keynote. I covered one of these on 9to5 Mac last week. It was called, Duet Cam. So we're talking about dual camera apps, and this is called Duet Cam. And the first thing I like about Duet Cam is the app icon. I just think is really cool looking. It's like two-sided camera lens with like a gradient purple background. I think it's kind of cool. And the app has had some updates since it launched, but you know, I think this is like the main one that I'm using. You can now do things like move the picture of you around. You can switch between the cameras easier. There have been some really fast updates since the app launch. It's like here's a hobby project kind of thing. But this is an app that I like and recommend. And then you've spent some time with another one that after I posted about Duet Cam, some readers recommended called GEMI. I think Gemini, but I'm going to call it Gemmy.
Yeah, well, I guess it's a play on like Gemini.
I guess.
Yeah. But that's cool as well. And I think it had stuff where you could move the profile, you know, like the front camera around before Duet Cam updated. So it's nice here that Duet Cam's kind of come in line. But they're both, you know, same text and same concept. And you can do split screen. You can do, you know, circle and a big thing. You can do split diagonally. And they don't. The problems with the ones that are out like day one of iOS 13 launch is they just made your phone really, really hot and it kind of burned. It just felt like it was like burning your chip up. The Duet Cam and Gemini do a much better job of like performance management, and they do the job as well. So it's a nice touch. And I kind of wish Apple had included some basic form of multi-camera recording in the actual camera app, just so you didn't have to go to the App Store to do it. But the App Store choices are pretty good.
Yeah, I kind of, now that we're seeing how this goes, that there's a difference in a good app and a bad app and how it treats your phone. You know, that's something that's hard to consider, but once you see them, it's real. And then that there's a basic implementation of this using two cameras, one in the front, one in the back. And then there's a lot more to that that people will request. And then seeing those updates come out, that Apple could easily do a very basic version, which is, you know, pick one of the back cameras, pick one of the front cameras, and there's not any customization as to like where the pip is or, you know, how you split it up.
Yeah, and just cut it right down the middle and say that's it.
And that would be totally cool. More people would know about what their phones can do, whether it's a XS, XR, XS Max, 11, 11 Pro, 11 Pro Max, like those phones and later. And it'd be built in. And then if you want more out of it, like people said when Duet Cam launched, I want this, this, and this, then you go to the apps when you find something that can do it. I think the Gemini one has like a watermark on the video unless you maybe pay or something. I haven't looked into how to get rid of that, but I did see it in your sample footage. the Duet Cam, I think it's a purchase app that you buy one time, and then you, you know, there's no worry about the watermark. Maybe they're even in the cost. But I had a cool experience just like walking around the woods near my home and like filming the walk plus like me. You know, it's kind of like the sky. You really get the environment. So it's a cool
system. It's definitely a feature that you could see Apple doing an add-on, because it's a very like ad good for television kind of ad commercial thing, where it's just like, look, I'm recording this and I'm recording the front camera, and it's like
I mean,
it just works
like a video. There's somebody that would look really good on an ad, like you think of like something that we experience often here where I live is you've got a tropical storm or a hurricane, and you're recording the video of what you're seeing with like wind speeds and rain plus yourself in that environment, and that's a compelling video as like man on the ground report, person on the ground report, or like a birthday party and you're recording like all the kids plus yourself talking to the camera because you're sending it off to family and saying like, hey, wish you could be here, kind of thing. You can do some really cool ads with this feature, and you can do some really cool things in practice, with these apps. I've got dark mode and swipe keyboard in the notes too. I mentioned that at the beginning of the topic. The thing with dark mode that I've got to say this week is that with the LCD screen on the 11 phone, I was doing auto switch by sunset and sunrise. And, for whatever reason on the OLED screen, I guess it's because, it's only lighting up pixels that are in use. I'm using dark mode all the time. And there is the difference of the phone has a higher brightness, potentially in sunlight. And I've actually got like really bad eyes where in one eye especially, it's kind of like a mix between like light colors and grayscale. And so anything that's requires putting light through to see it, I have trouble seeing it. And so screen brightness, whether it's the Apple Watch going to 1,000 nits the first time or any iPhone level change year over year in outdoor light, I really appreciate. And so that was also a factor with the Pro phones have this brighter display. You can't turn it all the way up on your own, but if you're in sunlight and it's needed, it'll crank up there for you. So I've appreciated that. And it does help with dark mode and sunlight, which is something that Guy Rambo on the 9to5 Mac Stack Trace podcast mentioned. And those are selling features for me too. And then the swipe keyboard. I mentioned to you when I had the 11 and hadn't made the change yet, that I was using swipe with less accuracy, because what I've decided was that the bigger keyboard and then the size of my hand and thumb and reach made it where swiping was just less efficient than typing out with two thumbs or even like one thumb reaching across. Back on the 5.8 inch screen, and I am super efficient at swipe typing again.
Yeah, the swipe's cool. I know a lot of people on Twitter have complained it's not as good as Gboard and stuff, but it seems good enough. It doesn't seem terrible. Like, I use it, and it's nice that you don't have, like, a separate mode. You can type if you want, or you can just immediately start swiping, and you can swipe instead. So you can switch between quite organically, depending on what you're doing.
Yeah.
I've definitely used it. Like, it's survived 5 months of being in beta now, whatever, and I still use it on occasion. Like, I wouldn't say it's primary, but it's definitely secondary, and there are some situations that just makes more sense. When I'm normally one-handing the phone, I swipe. I still kind of inclined towards two thumb typing if I'm doing like a long message. I don't even know if it's faster or slower. It's just what you're used to,
it's
I guess.
It's pleasant, yeah.
Yeah, but especially if you're one-handed, it like swiping's so much better than tapping out with one thumb. Mm-hmm. I found.
Yeah. I use tapping to type out primarily, and then swipe typing. Now that it's built in, I wouldn't bother with a third-party keyboard, but choose what you like. And then dictation. I have family who they use dictation primarily, and just from what I've seen, it seems to be that the older you are, the more efficient dictation is, because it's easier than like hunting down and tap typing and that kind of thing. But I've got family that uses dictation primarily and then tap typing next. But for me, I'm using swiping way more than dictation, where it's like probably at least once a day, and dictation is like once a month maybe.
Yeah.
Yep.
Thanks to our friends at Smile Software for sponsoring Happy Hour. Text Expander is an incredible Mac productivity tool to have in your arsenal. Make everything you write repetitively available everywhere you type. Text documents, spreadsheets, web forms, and more. Turn the things you type into reusable snippets to access them time and time again. And for iPhone and iPad users, Text Expander has just updated their app for iOS 13 with dark mode and more. Text Expander goes beyond simple find and replace. With variables and forms, snippets are much more powerful. You can quickly stamp out an invoice with easily editable fields to change only the bits that need to be customized for each individual. Text Expander is applicable to so many situations. Email addresses, signatures, chunks of code, form letters, hard-to-spell names, even images. Anywhere that you need consistent and accurate text. If you've ever written something twice, there's a good chance you could work smarter and use a Text Expander snippet instead. For instance, if you're a developer like me who has to do live presentations, you can use Text Expander to store bits of code and avoid embarrassing mistakes by letting Text Expander insert the code snippets into your IDE as you concentrate on the core message of your presentation. Text Expander is available for macOS, iPhone, iPad, Windows, and Chrome OS. Text Expander for Teams adds a whole extra layer for coordinating work with others. Snippets can be shared automatically across the organization, you can manage which members of your team have access to different snippets with Text Expander groups, and you can even see statistics about which snippets are being used more than others, so you can focus on tuning up any errors that are being ignored. Companies use Text Expander for Teams for customer support, reporting, and so much more. Shared snippets unify your organization's voice. Unlock your productivity with Text Expander. Listeners to this show can get 20% off their first year subscription. Visit textexpander.com/podcast to learn more and sign up. That's textexpander.com/podcast.
Hi, Mayo. I want to give an update on the Apple Watch Series 5 review process for me. As I mentioned last week, I've had really big problems with battery life and getting through a single day compared to the Series 4 or even like an old Apple Watch. So the process that I went through was, you know, try always on, turned off. Okay, I got a little bit more battery life, but not enough to matter. It's still a problem. Try without cellular, try without the noise app, try without something that people recommend is, do you use the solar face? I mean, that will use your location, even if it's not your active face. And I didn't use that, so that wasn't it. Try unpairing and repairing, and try restoring, you know, that kind of thing. None of it worked. So I was on two options: return this thing and try another unit, or try the beta. And the watchOS 6.2 beta 2 was out by the time I resorted to that. And I couldn't tell on day one because I had installed it that day. But the next day I did another test of like 6 a.m. until, let's see when this thing dies. And I did everything the same way I always do, which is partially with the phone away on the cellular, but not for more than 30 minutes in each day. Do a 30 minute to 1 hour workout with the phone, either with me or away. Doesn't matter. And the first day I usually would go from 6 to noon and have 50% remaining. But on the first day of testing, I went from 6 a.m. to 3 p.m. with 50% remaining, which was 9 hours. And so then I, you know, tweeted out as an update, like, wow, I'm getting 9 hours on this beta. No other change. And if you double 50%, it'll give me 18 hours as advertised. And sure enough, like, it was 17 hours and 30 minutes when it actually died to 0%, which was around 11:30 p.m. And so I was impressed. The next day, it was very similar to that. It was one day where it was still like subpar, and the watch died around 9 p.m. So it wasn't quite that long, but that was kind of in the range of like normal for what the old Series 3 would do or older watches would do. And then today I looked at 3 p.m. after waking up and putting the watch on at 6 a.m. and it was at exactly 50%. And so I kind of consider this like case closed. It's a software problem that wasn't affecting everybody, but the beta fixes it. What we don't know is...
Or at least it fixes it coincidentally.
Sure. Yeah. What we don't know is, when will this update come out? And I've updated my story on the problem to reflect this, but when does the update come out? We don't really know. Probably in the next month or two, but we're not positive. Could be November. And then also, is it intentional that they're doing this update to address a problem that they haven't given a statement on in the press? Because maybe it's coincidence, like you say, you know.
Yeah, because it could just be true that like factory reset in the watch would somehow click whatever was broken back into shape and the battery life improves. Because it's not like everyone is on the beta
that's
saying, yeah, I know, but like, yeah, maybe you do it 5 times in a row and 1 time it works, and then the bait is just another way of doing that, right? Like, yeah. We don't know for sure that there is a battery life issue that the beta addresses, and Apple won't say. So yeah. Unless the release notes, when the release notes finally come out for this update, do actually say it directly, it's still kind of up in the air. Like,
and I have asked with no answer, of course, but I did ask.
Yeah, I know. Because when the iPhone iOS 13.0. Whatever came out, it actually had like battery life addresses a battery life issue in the release notes, and so we don't actually have any like firm confirmation for that for the watch side of life, which would be nice given that it is actually like a major issue for a lot of people. But it does seem like a lot of people are having a lot of success getting good battery life again by updating to the beta, so it seems like that is going to fix it, but we don't want to like, you know, bet on it just yet because it's right. Not 100% known.
Yeah, I've not written the review yet because
yeah, exactly.
I'm waiting for this update to be out and to see what it does for other people. This is part of the review for the next year. And people on Twitter have asked me, you know, I'm on the last day. Should I return this thing or wait for the beta or try the beta? And you know, I can't tell anyone go past your return date and then do a gamble. But I have said if you have to return it, wait for this watchOS 6.2 update to come out. And then if all the reports are clear, you know, and I'll let you know, then you just go back and buy it again. Because it was a funny thing where you're telling me about, with your iPhone 11 Pro, your battery life there, what happened where you didn't charge, but you thought you did?
Yeah. I like put my foot. So normally I charge my phone at night, right? So on this day, I just forgot to plug it in. I just left it on the floor. And didn't actually plug it in. And the next day, my phone battery lasted all the way through to the evening. And I percentage-wise, I basically got what my iPhone 10 would do in 1 day on the 11 Pro, but over 2 days because I didn't charge it overnight, which was kind of incredible. Like, the iPhone 11/Pro battery is so much better than what I've been, you know, accustomed to on the iPhone 10. Mm. It's really, like, world-changing, really. Like, I can literally miss a night of charging and still have enough battery to go through the majority of the next day.
Yeah, so on my wife's 40 millimeter Series 5 with cellular and always on, it was like lunchtime on Saturday. I forget what day it was. It was lunchtime of one day, and she got the low power modes, you know, soon alert. Your battery's got 20% or whatever, and or 10%. And she said, "What? I'm getting bad battery life today too." And I was like, "Oh, that's really weird. You know, what's going on?" And when we were back home, she had realized that her charger was plugged in to like, it's like a 2-port charger thing. And it was plugged in at the charging part on the desk, but, at the wall, it was not plugged in. And so she actually got, you know, from like what, probably 8 a.m. until lunchtime the next day on a single charge on a smaller watch than mine. I will say, like, I'm not getting amazing battery life every single day. It's still kind of hit or miss, but I was just missed before. Now I'm having like multiple hits in a week.
Yeah, it is like dramatically better than your first 2 weeks of using it.
Yeah, like right now I've got 33% at 4:21 p.m. from 6 a.m. to 4:21 p.m. and I'm a little bit nervous about that. Like, I don't know if I'll need to charge before I do a workout or not later this evening. But part of it is that I went from looking at 50% as 6 hours to now 50% is 9 hours. And so that makes the percentages feel a lot different too. You know, so now 33% can be, you know, is actually more than it was when I was having bad battery life because, you know, it's not going to die in, you know, two hours. So.
Yeah. Each percentage point represents more minutes than it
yes,
did before.
It really
yeah.
does. And there's been a few cool things this week too in the Apple Watch space. For example, Alan Dye, who is the vice president of human interface design at Apple, meaning the things that are not hardware, but that you use in software. He appeared on Hodinkee Radio, which is a podcast for the Hodinkee, like high end mechanical watch world. And they also usually do a week on the wrist review of the Apple Watch edition of the year. But Alan Dye was on that podcast and spoke for about 20 minutes out of the hour to discuss sort of the design process of Apple Watch faces. And it was kind of funny timing because there's been this whole thing this year where the worst complaint about the watch, if battery life is fine, then the complaint is there are new watch faces, but I still can't find a watch face that works for me. I don't really have that problem, but I know a lot of people do. And there's this, you know, there's naturally this appeal for, you know, people want third party watch faces. And especially with Always On, like you could do some cool things there. And we're not there yet. And so it was kind of funny to have this sort of meme in the community of Apple can't do a nice watch face. And then to have Alan Dye on a podcast to talk about how Apple, you know, the intentionality in designing each watch face and like what goes behind it.
It was like an accidental subtweet.
Yeah, but it was recorded the day after the event, and I think a lot of the like that notion boiled up in the weeks after the event. So I don't think it was intentional, but it really looked funny.
It's always nice to hear Apple executives' opinions on stuff, but
yeah.
I didn't think this interview was the best ever heard. There was a lot of like, there wasn't a lot of like hard hitting questions or stuff that was new really for me. It was one of those Apple interview I've ever had.
Yeah, it wasn't like a hard hitting interview. It was one of those things where like the interviewee and the person from Hodinkee liked the topics that they were talking about, and then Alan Dye, of course, is going to cheerlead for what he's talking about. I mean, there was some stuff like this is what we're thinking, but if you had read this anywhere else, you already know. What I found neat is that Alan Dye has done numerous press interviews around the watch. There was never that level of exposure whenever he was like, you know, equal to Hayworth.
Yeah, Hayworth.
Yeah. But there were lots of like print interviews, and I wasn't aware of a video interview or a podcast interview before this. So you get to hear him in his own voice.
Well, maybe they're trying to promote him again, given Johnny's walking out the door soon.
Yeah, funny, huh? But what was cool is they had a photo supplied from Apple of his watch face, like on his wrist, and it was the California dial and the California format watch face, full screen, where you've got half Roman numerals and then half Arabic numerals, and it was in the edition color, which is like white, sort of gray on white. And the top complication was the monograms, how you call it? Where's your initials? Mm-hmm. Yep. So
yeah, monogram.
Yeah. So it was AC. No, it was, I don't know, I forget what it was, but it was Alan something Die. So it was A something D. I think it was an AC. I don't know what it was.
Yeah, anyway. I think it was ACD because when I first saw it, I thought it said ACDC.
But, right. You can do up to like, I think, six characters there.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it was that.
But that's an example. It's funny that that's the face that he uses, given that it's one of the ones that, you know, we'd kind of reject because it's the flash of white on the background. And that was actually brought up in the interview. He was talking about how they'd made faces with splashes of colors. And I was hoping the Hodinkee, you know, person would have pushed back on it a bit and say, well, how do you think that interoperates with going to Always On where it dims out fully? And they kind of like tiptoed around the subject without really going at it wholeheartedly, which is kind of what I was looking for. Like, you know, do you think that these full color watch faces are actually good for the Series 5 now that you get the kind of abrupt transition from the dim mode to the use, you know, the active mode, but he seems to use it himself, like he uses full white.
Yeah, and it was obviously like one of many faces that he uses, but that was the top complication, and the bottom one was his activity rings, and it just looked kind of, I mean, it looked very, you know, it looked nice, and I tweeted out a picture of like that and then doing the same thing on my watch, and then also with my watch the always on mode, the rest mode where it was black. It's a cool style, and it's just an example of like how even with the existing watch faces you can do so many things, and I take pride in like putting together watch faces that I like, but I never would have done that one. But then having recreated it, there are people who told me I've never liked a single watch face before now, or I've never wanted the edition before now because of that watch face. So you know, my big takeaway there is something we mentioned last week. Rather than populate the watch gallery with what's the newest complication in software this year, it's what do we really think is like timeless, regardless of there's a new compass in the watch. Now we're going to promote the compass. There's now sailors. We're going to do that, you know, whatever the new app is. Instead, what are some actually good looking watch faces that have nothing to do with the hardware change of the year? You know what I mean?
Yeah. Like the best of Hall of Fame versus here's what's new.
Right. Cause they have that. They have new in watchOS. So why not do the gallery that way? But anyway, the other thing about the Apple Watch this week is you know, Guy Rambo at 9to5Mac had this awesome reporting before the event of this is precisely what Apple's been working on for sleep tracking for the watch, and this is how it will work. Before that, it was only rumored or reported from Bloomberg that it will come next year, but it wasn't super in detail because it was pretty early out yet. Well, Rambo, through his sources, found lots of details about how it will actually work. And, you know, it wasn't part of the event. It's probably meant for next year's watch at this point. This got referenced this week from Apple, right?
Apple managed to mess up again. So with WatchOS 6, they let you delete some stock apps. And obviously when you delete a stock app, you need to be able to re-download it from somewhere, and you re-download it from the App Store. And this has been on the iPhone for ages, but it's new to the watch for WatchOS 6. And so apps like the Alarms app and the Breathe app all have App Store listings now that you can go and find. Well, it turns out that the screenshot associated with the Alarms app did not match the actual UI that you see when you use the Alarms app yourself, because it included a content region for sleep. And it literally says, set your bedtime and wake up in the sleep app, capital S sleep app. And so the bedtime alarm exists on the phone, and it will vibrate your watch and make it ring, but you can't actually set it or change it from the watch itself. So this whole UI does not exist on the shipping software. They just accidentally left it in the screenshots for the App Store listing before it got pulled, because presumably someone saw that, oh, we're not doing the sleep app yet, we'll get rid of that. But they forgot that in the Alarms app, which is a different app, but it has sleep functionality in it, clearly they didn't forget to undo the new screenshot. Yeah, so we have official confirmation that Apple is actually working on a capital S sleep app for the watch.
Mm-hmm. Whether it's for old watches, new watches, future watches, we don't know yet, but because that could always change before they ship it. But this is the most official word from Apple that they are doing their own sleep tracking, besides, you know, buying Bedit years and years ago.
They've done so well this year as well with, like, not having self-leaks, it felt like.
Yeah.
We haven't had anything major, and then this pops along, which isn't the biggest one in the world, but still, you know, I guess you plug every hole and still you miss one. That's what happens in these kind of situations.
It is an exciting one, and so that's kind of what makes it feel prominent.
Yeah, it's a good one.
Yep.
ExpressVPN is a simple and reliable way to make sure that your network traffic is secure wherever you are without noticeable impacts on your internet speed. Public Wi-Fi security measures are always under attack, with unscrupulous actors looking to steal your sensitive and private information however they can. Take back your privacy with ExpressVPN. ExpressVPN secures and anonymizes your internet browsing by encrypting your data and hiding your public IP address so no one can see what you're doing. To enable ExpressVPN, it just takes one click. Download the app, click to connect, and instantly 100% of your network data is secured. ExpressVPN invented technology called Trusted Server to make sure that no one can keep logs of what you're doing online. Their VPN servers run off RAM, and no logging is stored to permanent disk storage. It has easy-to-use apps that run seamlessly in the background of your computer, phone, and tablet. One subscription applies to every device you own, from Macs to iPhones to iPads, even Android phones, home routers, and other devices too. Use ExpressVPN to surf public Wi-Fi without fear of being snooped on, and keep your personal data private. ExpressVPN has 24/7 human support to help you get up and running, and they are recommended as the number one VPN provider from sites like CNET and TechRadar. If you want the best in online security and privacy protection, head over to expressvpn.com/happyhour for 3 extra months free with a 1-year package. Protect your internet today. Go to expressvpn.com/happyhour to get started.
All right, Mayo, let's knock out a hashtag ask 9to5Mac question. This is the segment that we do every now and then, where if you tweet a question to either Benjamin or myself on Twitter, you can include the hashtag ask 9to5Mac, and we'll see the question in our tweet deck column, and then we'll address it on the show eventually. This is one from several weeks ago, from Brian Stetler on Twitter. He's at Kingston2. And His question is, say all things are equal. You have an iPhone XS and an Apple Watch Series 4, so last year's new stuff. Which is the one to upgrade? Which is the upgrade to get this year? Is it the iPhone 11 Pro from the XS or the Apple Watch Series 5 from the Series 4? And
you have to pick one or the other.
Yeah, you can't pick both. You've got to, your budget only lets you upgrade one of the two things. Before we kind of nailed it down, my first answer was, it's a good question, but it really depends on what you have and how long you keep devices. And how long you keep devices is still a factor there, I think. So I've kind of got two responses here. The first one is that the Apple Watch Series 4 to Series 5 is such a small upgrade year over year that it's really hard to say go that route. You get the always on display. It can dramatically change how you use the watch in terms of like not needing to raise your wrist, seeing information faster in like a workout scenario. The compass, I don't think is game changer, which I don't think is crazy to say. And the Series 4 is a really good watch, even has the same processor, like speed wise as the Series 5. So unless you want titanium for the look or ceramic because you've always wanted that like me, then it's hard to say go Series 4 to Series 5, but that is an upgrade that could be nearly no cost because you can probably sell your Series 4 for, $200 to $300 because it's no longer on the market. And it's better than the Series 3, which is sold for $200 new. So it's got some value. You can trade into Apple for up to like $110. That's something. And then the Series 5, you're looking at from $400 versus an iPhone. If you're saying 11 Pro from $1,000, so it can be the smallest upgrade, but it can also be the smallest, hit to your wallet. But it's similar for the phone though, because it's like the phone, if you only want to upgrade to one of the new things this year, you have a XS already, unless you care a lot about the camera stuff, then the phone, in this case, maybe the answer would be wait on both. But again, you can factor in selling your phone, trading in your phone, and then going to the 11 Pro. But it's really how important is always on display for you if you're coming from last year's watch, and then how important are the new camera features if you're upgrading the phone, make that decision. But if you've got to just do one and neither one appeals to you, then I would say sit it out and wait until an even bigger upgrade in the future.
That's kind of avoiding the question, though. You've got to pick one.
Okay, you pick one.
You can assume the cost difference is irrelevant, right? So you can choose, do you want the watch or do you want the phone?
Mm-hmm. I don't want the phone, yeah.
And so what you're essentially coming down to is the impact on your life of an always on display versus the impact on your life of taking substantially better photos every single time.
Well, okay, then I will say do the phone because, as enthusiastic about the watch as I am, I was surprised by how much the new phone upgrade year over year impressed me even before 11 Pro when it was just 11, for example, which can be, like for my wife, I think we spent $100 to upgrade her through trade-in from an 11 or from a 10S Max to an 11 non-pro. I'm gonna pick phone just because, even if you're not a camera person, you can probably be surprised at what you can do. It isn't just that your camera pick, your quality is better, high resolution, but you can actually take different shots with ultra wide.
Yeah, I think the phone has to be the obvious choice here because always on is nice, but it is kind of like an added extra onto a fantastic watch as it was in the form of the Series 4. Whereas, especially if you're on the XS, not the XS Max, you're getting like a combination double hit of better photos and better battery life. Like the battery life situation is such a big deal for me, and I know you didn't experience it as much, but for me, going from like the iPhone 10 5.8 inch form factor through to 11 Pro, it's so, I don't have to cradle the phone in the evenings anymore, and it makes such a big difference. Plus you get better back cameras and the front camera is actually good now. Like I think if you're just looking at both and you're weighing a new watch or a new phone, and the cost delta isn't really a factor, it's just you've got enough budget for one or the other, I think you have to pick phone every time. As much as I love the watch, but if you've already got Series 4, I think you're better off holding out, especially as we're still in the kind of, qualifying the Series 5 with the battery life situation, even in the best cases, is still not as good as what you might be used to with your Series 4. So especially if you do stuff like street sleep tracking as it is today, the Series 5 is not going to be as good as that, right? Even in the perfect world where the beta fixes the battery and it goes to like an 18 hours, it still seems like the Series 4 is outpacing, you know, the best Series 5 devices, right? So I think the 11 Pro has to be the answer. It's a good question.
It is a good question.
If you were going from like a Series 3, if it was Series 3 or like iPhone 10, you know, going two generations back, mm-hmm. I think it would flip and then you'd pick the watch because you get the bigger jump on the form factor of the watch as the bigger screen, and plus you get always on. Whereas the phone, the difference between the 10 to 11 Pro is smaller. But just going from the last two generations, I think the iPhone wins.
Yeah, my big takeaway from this is really explore trade-in value, resale value, even without getting tied up in carrier contracts with upgrade programs there, or even Apple's upgrade program, that without any sort of a contract, you can probably get a pretty good deal on last year's stuff to go to this year's stuff without paying $1,000 or $400, you know, depending on if it's the watch, the phone. I was quite surprised by that this year. Let's talk now about the release of macOS Catalina and then, you know, some of the new features there and then some of kind of what we think about that. This has been in beta all summer. It did not release alongside iOS 13 and iPadOS 13 or tvOS 13, watchOS 6. It came after everything, but not by too much. Apple said October once they knew it wasn't going to be released in September. And this could easily have been the end of October, but it was first week or so.
Yeah, and I wasn't running the betas at all through the summer. I just upgraded to Catalina Final on the Monday when it came out. Mm-hmm. So it's been, you know, kind of a blast of new stuff from my perspective. I know you were like on and off the betas on your various computers for the summer period. Yeah. But I upgraded relatively painlessly. There was some weirdness where I had like a new like relocated items folder on my desktop, and it had some files in it that kind of looked important, but I didn't have permission to open the files, so I kind of like threw caution to the wind and just deleted them all and just hoped that everything would be okay. I mean, I had backups and stuff, right? But yeah, it seems fine. I know some people have had issues with like iCloud telling them to repeatedly log in. I haven't had any of those problems. And the big thing about Catalina this year in terms of, you know, should you upgrade or not, is the 64-bit transition, right? So in most years, I just tell anyone to upgrade when the device tells you to. This time around, there's more of a breakpoint in the Mac's existence where if you have older software that is not 64-bit compatible, you know, you're kind of out of luck. You're at the behest of the publishers and the developers, right? Like if you just have plugins, older plugins, if you have drivers for certain things, if you have a weird scanner that's kind of been ignored, if you don't want to go to like Adobe Creative Cloud subscription and you want to stick on like the Photoshop before you had to like subscribe to it, all of those things are factors. And, you know, moving to Catalina, those things just don't work anymore. So there's definitely more of a kind of like app survey you should do before you like press the button. Luckily for me, I'm not really impacted by any of that stuff because I just tend to use like Twitter clients messaging, Xcode and things like that. Like I don't really have much legacy stuff, thankfully, that I have to worry about. My biggest concern while I was waiting for Catalina to come out was Skype Call Recorder, which is what I use to record the backup audio for this podcast. Luckily, they updated like a week before Catalina came out, so I was very happy about that. That anxiety went away. And my upgrade process has been basically seamless. I think your experience is similar, right?
If I hadn't ran the betas, I wouldn't have known about the pain points, because in the first beta version, I couldn't edit. I had the Catalina on my Mac Pro, and I couldn't edit the podcast in Logic or in any audio in Logic on the beta. Files were becoming like half-second clips and things like that. And then there was the other thing where Call Recorder from Ecamm didn't work for most of the summer, and I didn't know about the update until Catalina's release day, because I just didn't have it on my computer anymore. Because for me, like I thought about it, and I thought maybe I'll have like one, because I've got the iMac and I've got a MacBook Pro, so I thought maybe I'll have the iMac always on Mojave as the 32-bit compatible machine, and then I'll have the MacBook Pro on the newest version. And you know, I thought about that, and I was going to do that, but then Logic started working again on the beta, and it was just down to Call Recorder. And so the benefits of some of the new apps in the OS, and you know, having the same OS on both machines for compatibility's sake, and the nature of our jobs, having access to the latest software for testing is pretty important. So I couldn't say, well, I'm going to do it just for Call Recorder. So what I did was quickly say goodbye to Call Recorder and then find a new solution that wasn't exactly as good, but was, you know, workable. And so that was my approach, was just, you know, like almost like when you move to USB-C, you know, I didn't want to find a bunch of adapters. I wanted to replace all my cables with USB-C ends. Same thing here. I wanted to replace Call Recorder with something that was 64-bit. And then luckily on the day of release, you know, I learned, oh, they do have an update. So now we're back to all of our old workflows, just on the new version. But, you know, I also don't have, you know, like legacy software that I've used in college and before, or anything that I use professionally that won't work.
Yeah, I mean, one example was GarageBand 6, right? Which is what you used to use a while ago for podcast authoring, correct?
Yeah, and that was obviously not supported. There was a new version out. And Apple's been giving these 64-bit warnings for a while. Like last fall or so, they started having a pop-up aggressively to say, contact the developer, this app won't work in the next version of Mac OS. And they've been saying it in keynotes even longer. So I knew, oh, I need to move from that. There aren't the features in the new GarageBand, but I can get Logic and then do the same thing there. So I did. I moved on to Logic a while ago. There was a learning curve, but I didn't need to make the transition on the day that 64-bit was the only, you know, only apps I could run and 32-bit was dead. I looked at the signs that Apple was sending. You know,
yeah, you literally heeded the warnings.
Right. And so I had access to both. And so if I couldn't figure something out in Logic yet, I would just resort to GarageBand at the time. And you know, and then once I was comfortable enough with Logic, I would just move from GarageBand. I think it was like version like 6.1.2 or something, or 6.2.3. I had it like file named out like that on the app so that it wouldn't interfere with the new GarageBand. But yeah, and the other things here, there was another app that we used to use, which is a Levelator. Levelator for getting our audio, you know, kind of the same sound level without doing a bunch of work by hand. And you know, it's just an app where you drag the file, drop it onto the app, process it, and then spits out a new file. And it was really convenient for our workflow. But that was not a supported app on any level. Like, you know, any macOS version could have broken that, but especially requiring 64-bit. And so we discussed on the show as a topic every now and then of like what we will use next. We went weeks where we didn't have good leveling, you know, as we were trying different things out as an experiment. And we ended up doing this app called Aphonic, which has a web version that you can use. I think you subscribe and you use credits to use it on the web. But they've also got a Mac app that you can purchase with a one-time license. And so that's what I've been using on the Mac, is Aphonic. And if I'm using iOS to edit, because, you know, there's this app, Ferrite, on the iPad and the iPhone, that I've used both to edit podcasts that are released. But it's got the same tools that I use on the Mac in like three different apps, but in a single app. And it was in a scenario where I didn't have to learn it on the fly. Like, I never want to do a thing where I can't release an episode if I don't learn the software or I don't find the solution in the software. I want it to be, I have an option, but I'm learning new things for the sake of, you know, expanding what I know. And in all those cases, you know, moved to Logic before 64-bit was the only thing you could use. And then I learned to do this on the iPad. Even if I don't do it every week, I can in a pinch. And that's been useful even on the iPhone. I've edited some podcasts and released them.
Yeah. So to Apple's credit, they have been given, you know, literal warnings and alerts in the software for a while. So, but there's always people that just ignore that stuff and don't do their research and don't do the homework. So if you're one of those people, you should definitely do check up on your situation before you press the button, because it is a hard break. And, you know, you can emulate an old version of macOS if you really have to, but it's not ideal. So, yeah. And it mainly affects, like, you're talking about things that have direct alternatives. There are just some peripherals and accessories and workflows that, you know, are baked in a 32-bit world, whether it's software or apps or drivers, whatever, and there's just no way out. So you always have to, like, heed that and be careful of that. But in general, I think most people will be able to upgrade to Catalina without anything major going away. A lot of the old games and stuff are gone, sadly, but you know, Mac gaming was never great. It's kind of it's just basically highlighting all the stuff that was already abandoned in a way.
And we have at least one tutorial on the Notepad Mac that we'll link in the show notes if you want to look at your system before you update and see what will be lost. I obviously we can't give a blanket recommendation for everybody, but yeah. There are reasons that you would want to update new features that you get, new apps that you get, and just by it just may be the case that you don't lose a single app and have to find a replacement or wait, you know. Let's talk about some of those apps. iTunes is no longer an app. It's now music, TV, and podcast. And in my experience, all three apps I'm very happy with. I'm not searching for features that I used to use. Even in music, like a lot of the changes in music happened in iTunes before. Like, it used to be ratings used to be heavily, it was one system. It was star ratings 1 through 5. You couldn't give a 0, I don't think, but it was 1 through 5. If you hated a song, it was 1 star, not 0. If you loved a song, it was 5. And if you had any thoughts in between, you could pick a 2, a 3, or a 4. They replaced that with hearts by default. And once Apple Music was put into iTunes as a feature, and the idea there is you either really like something or you're neutral. And then you can also dislike it if you don't want to see recommendations like that in the future. That's still in the new music app. You can go into the system preferences or the iTunes or music app preferences and then say show stars. So you can see both. Lots of things that were used to be in iTunes are still there in music. And I've not had an experience where there's something I used to use that I've lost. And, I do a few things like make my own playlist, for example. Put this playlist into folders, which you can't do on iOS, but you can see them on iOS. And, things like that, I'm not missing out on. So I'm happy so far. TV, I'm actually using my iMac as like a watch shows now thing too. And same for the MacBook Pro. And then podcasts, I've written a lot over the years about how iTunes and podcasts was subpar. And how I like the Apple podcast ecosystem, but it was just the weakest link was on the Mac, even if that was, helpful that it was even there at all. It could still be improved. Now it has been improved.
Yeah. There's just straight up. There's an inherent benefit to splitting out all of the different like views of media inside of iTunes into dedicated apps, right? Just splitting out the podcast interface, splitting out the movies and TV show stuff into separate apps is a great start. The new music app, I get the sense, it's mostly, they almost could have just carried on calling it iTunes. Like, it's just another iteration of them redesigning iTunes in a way. Like, I'm pretty sure most of the code's still the same.
You probably wouldn't even call it, like, iTunes, the new version. I think it was on 13 for a long time.
Yeah.
And you wouldn't even call it, like, iTunes 14. It would just be a new point version of iTunes.
Yeah. And obviously, they've taken out podcasts and TV and all that stuff. But outside of that, and that allowed them to simplify the UI a bit and remove some of the weird, like mode selector things that they had to have there. But in terms of just the raw music experience, it's mostly the same as it was before, even down to like the Apple Music integration. Like, it's not a Apple Music client first with the old stuff like packed into it. It's still very much, you can kind of feel like how this thing is based on a file and folder structure, under the hood, and it still feels old in that way, right? Which is not necessarily a bad thing. It definitely means that a lot of the potential features that could have been gone if they'd done like a full rewrite are still there. But it's not like they're jumping ahead. I don't get the sense of anyway. Podcasts is a much better experience than what you used to get in iTunes. Podcasts is the only one out of the three which is a Catalyst app, by the way. Although they do a lot of weird tricks to, they basically bias the Catalyst experience of podcasts in their favor because they do a lot of stuff that isn't like available to third parties. They just do that stuff to make podcasts still be good, if you know what I mean. Like, there's a lot of stuff that podcasts does that a third party Catalyst app isn't really allowed to do, but it doesn't like, from a user's perspective, the podcast app feels pretty Mac native. I have like some user interface concerns across all three apps, but I had user interface concerns with iTunes as well. Like, iTunes was not a darling, right? It wasn't like a shining light. It was always that thing where it was like, it was good, and now it's like okay. And now I feel like you've still got a music app, which is like okay. And then you've got podcasts, which is much better than what you the podcast view that you used to have inside of iTunes. Plus, they have the new features from iOS, like the search and lyric stuff. And then TV. You know, the TV app on iOS is bad. The TV app on Apple TV is good. The TV app on the Mac, on Mac OS Catalina, it's like okay. it feels very like WebView-y. I'm not sure if it's actually a WebView or not, but every time you click on something, it has to like load the page. The page goes white, then everything comes into view. Then you click on something else, and the page goes blank, and then it loads it. Like, it's not the best. It's definitely not the best they could do. It's kind of like minimum bar-ish, but it is giving you features that iTunes didn't even have, because now you can actually view like all the Apple TV channels inside Apple TV, mm-hmm. right? Like, it's not like the iOS version where you can get the up next queue of all the different random apps on your phone or on the TV.
It's really like if you use the TV app on the Apple TV, it's like you have that on your Mac now, and you have your library of, you know, your purchases. Yeah. And you can, like, I like so much about this that I really can't complain about the new TV app, because you get 4K on the Mac for the first time for all the you could purchase 4K movies through the Apple TV, and they weren't downloaded, you know, in a way that you can access them later. They were just streamed, and you had to have an Apple TV 4K for that experience, and you couldn't do that on the Mac, even though you had, you know, 4K and 5K screens. And with the TV app, you can. And I'm happy with that. You can do Dolby Atmos sound. I think it might be on certain MacBook Pros. I'm not sure what's that's about, but you know, that's a cool thing to have. It's, you know, you finally get one UI for TV that is reflective, you know, on the TV and your Mac. The Mac was just in this old world before. It was like iTunes for videos. And it's kind of nice that you had, you know, both your library plus, you know, I did do a lot of TV watching from HBO and Showtime through the TV channels feature on the TV up on the Mac, because, you know, I've got a 55-inch OLED in the living room, but it's not close enough now where it's like feels immersive. I'm about to move, and then we can place it in a way that is immersive. But I just find that if I go up to my Mac, I'm much closer to it, and I can just see everything better. And, you know, a 27-inch screen right in front of you can be better than a 55-inch OLED too far away from you. So I watch a lot of TV shows that way. I haven't watched a movie that way yet, but I'm just looking at the TV app now. And when this TV Plus content comes, you know, part of it will be we want to look at some of this stuff, you know, for 9to5 Mac and for the podcast and have thoughts on it. And so we can do that from the Mac, and I like that a lot. And you don't get so much of the stuff that you see on the TV, on the Apple TV app, where you can be, you know, pushed off to another app because that isn't here yet. It's all just the TV app and then channel stuff.
Yeah, it's only exposing like iTunes and TV channels content, essentially. Mm-hmm. So it's almost like using the TV app on your Samsung Smart TV, right?
Yes.
Like that kind of feature set. Yeah, I guess my problems with the TV app on Catalina are the problems I kind of have for the TV app on iOS as well. So it's not really the Mac's fault specifically. It's just some of the design choices and stupid things they've done with TV in general, like how you have a library, but you can't like add a show from Apple TV channels into your library, mm-hmm. per se. It just kind of, like, the problem, the number one issue I have the TV app, it still feels like there's a siloed world of the purchase stuff and the streaming stuff. And whereas if you look at music on iOS or on the Mac, you can have your iTunes content, but it sits right alongside, you know, the Apple Music streaming library. Whereas with TV on whatever platform you're on, they have a library, but that really just means here's the stuff that you bought from iTunes. And then let's say you really like For All Mankind and you want to save that for later. So you want to add it to your library. You just can't, right? Like, it's still kind of like split into like a chasm of iTunes stuff and iTunes downloads and then all the streaming stuff, whether that's Apple TV Plus or just Apple TV channels in general. So those issues still remain, and I hope that they get worked on. Now that TV is kind of like split out on its own, there's almost more of a hope that they'll be able to like move all the platforms forward together. Whereas before, we saw that, you know, you got some improvements on iOS that would just never be on the Mac at all, because it was just like stuck in the old cruddy world of iTunes. So it's a good start. There's still a lot more that I wish they could do. And there's definitely like Mac specific stuff that they don't really explore that they could do if they put the time investment into it. But I'd still say, as a whole, the baseline of it, is it better than iTunes experience was? Yes. Is it the best Mac app? You know, are these the best Mac apps that are going to win loads of awards? No. It's kind of in that ballpark, if that makes sense.
I would give it an award. You don't get the weird autoplay stuff that you do on tvOS 13 now for the trailers, you know? It's just static images of the first thing in your up next queue, which is great. I guess because this isn't the home screen, it's the TV app itself. But I was thinking about this. Is like, if you... Lots of people do this. They use their Mac for their like portable TV, you know, for portable entertainment, whether it's music or podcast or video. And if you do that, you know, it's a much better experience now, you know. And it's too bad that, you know, I think Netflix told Bloomberg they won't do a Catalyst app. So you still go to the web for that. But if those things happen too, then that'll be nice, because just having an app for this kind of stuff, even if it's a web view and an app, then that's a little bit slow to appear and like low network connections. And I just like that way better. And I'm finding with all these new apps that my dock, it's getting, you know, there are more apps to put on the dock, but I'm finding a place for them because I'm using them enough that I, you know, they need to be there.
Yeah, it still does the autoplay when you're like diving into a specific show. So I just clicked on the morning show and like the background panorama does do the autoplaying previews and stuff. Again, audio's muted, but you're right, on the home screen it doesn't do that yet. So maybe again that's like a feature that they haven't got around to doing on the Mac side.
Please don't.
Yeah. I mean because they're gonna do an Apple TV app for the web when TV Plus launches as well at tv.apple.com. The kind of watch now tabs kind of feel like you're browsing that web app just in a window. So you know, that's how it is, if that makes, like, it does feel a lot like a web browsing experience, and I prefer something that's slightly more Mac native, but that's what we have for now, and it's definitely better than what they previously offered inside of iTunes.
Yeah, and you can find way worse UIs that change all the time in other services, whether it's their app or you know, the web. So I'm really happy with how usable this is too. I want to talk about Apple Arcade, because we've had access to Apple's game subscription service through the free trial period for the first month. On iOS, on the iPhone and iPod Touch, then on the iPad through iPadOS, and on the Apple TV through tvOS 13. Now we finally get it on the Mac for the first time. And we've been talking about this for the past few weeks, and it's kind of been a different context every week because of where we can play arcade games. But for me this week, I've finally taken like all of what we discussed and then made some decisions, which is that the phone has easy puzzle games, you know, quick kind of low attention, but like, you know, make you think games.
Yeah, like single button games a lot of the time.
Exactly. The TV, those are not good for the TV, but you can do, I've heard a lot of people say that the Apple TV HD or the Apple TV fourth generation is not good for games at all, especially the, you know, graphic stuff. On the 4K, yeah, on the 4K, I've had no problem at all. So I'm okay with having a bunch of, like, you know, for what Apple, or what Arcade has, graphic intensive games on the TV with a game controller. And I'm also kind of putting my iPad Pro in the same camp as the TV and the iMac, and you know, because I can treat it more like a TV now. And so I've put three games on the iMac: Skate City, Sayonara Hearts, or Sayonara Wild Hearts, and then Hot Lava. And I've played through, not to the completion, but just to try them out for a few minutes on the iMac Pro with the Xbox controller. We have PlayStation 4 controllers in the house. We have two for the console, but the process of, like, you know, pairing them to a new thing and then putting them back with the PlayStation, it wasn't great. And in reality, I was never going to do that. You know, very often I just wouldn't use controllers. So I went and bought, and also I decided I like Xbox's, like, the feel of the controller better than the PlayStation controller. So I went and bought an Xbox, I guess, one controller, and it's a phantom white color. So it's like half white, half transparent. You can see through it. And I really enjoyed myself, like, launching these games. They go to full screen by default. There's this mail bug on macOS where if you use Gmail, I think is the problem. Maybe even some of my cloud stuff where it launches the window on its own. And so if I had mill running...
And that's existed in Mojave as well.
Yes, yeah, totally.
It's long running.
Yes. I noticed that when the apps go full screen, mail would open a window and then it would split. It'd do split screen. So then I was like, oh, if I do any gaming, I'm going to need to close mail first because it takes over half the screen. After
yeah,
like
I had
minutes.
That exact same happen to me. I was playing Hot Lava yesterday and mail just decided to take over half the screen. I was like, great.
Yeah. But each of those more intensive games like that are like visually appealing and you probably need a controller, I wasn't going to do them like only on the iPad. And I haven't even played them with the iPad yet. Or the TV, really. Like, they're there, but I haven't really dived in yet. But on the Mac, like, in my desk chair, like, really comfortable, I found it to be really enjoyable. And I'm not paying for arcade whenever it's out for myself, but because the kids are having a great time with it, I don't mind, you know, taking advantage of it, too. And, you know, and then having a dedicated controller makes such a big difference.
Yeah, I've been loving arcade on the Mac, actually. Like, the Mac doesn't have a great game library up to now, so you know, like on the iPhone, arcade is competing with the App Store, right? Like, it's competing against the entire App Store. On the Mac, it's basically competing against nothing, because you know, the Mac was basically a barren wasteland in terms of, you know, the gaming stuff. And yeah,
you're a gamer, where I'm not. Is like Steam the place to go for Mac games?
Yeah, and to be honest, even if like yes, Steam has Mac games, but they run badly and they're old, right? Like, it's the, like, I have a Windows PC for a reason, right? If I want to play games on Steam, I play them on a Windows computer. It's just the reality. Whereas a lot of the games that you find in arcade are like Steam they're the kind of same kind of games that you'd find in Steam and you'd buy individually, but obviously they work on the Mac now properly and they're supported on the latest operating systems and stuff. Like Hot Lava began its life as a Steam Early Access game, which is kind of their like test flight trial thing, right? But you kind of like pay up front. It's not quite like test flights, but it's that same kind of like beta process. And now it's available. It would never have been released on the Mac without arcade being here. And I've played, you know, a good 2 hours of Hot Lava on the Mac on the Mac setup. It did have some wonkiness where it gave me like really bad default graphics options, so like it looked worse than the Apple TV HD by default. And I knew that, like, I've only got MacBook Pro, but I knew the graphics card's better than that, so I had to manually tweak the settings and get it to a environment where it was a better balance, right? And so now it's really, really fun, and I just pair I have a DualShock controller for the PlayStation, I pair that to the Mac, it works great. I am currently, I believe, number one out of all Game Center players on Hot Lava on about 4 of the different stages, which I don't know if is a reflection of how good I am or just that not many people are playing arcade, which is a different, you know, conversation altogether that we don't really know yet how much adoption this has got in the wider market. But I just think bringing arcade to the Mac makes arcade an even better deal and an even better value proposition than it ever was before. It's like News Plus is on the Mac and I don't care, right? But bringing arcade to the Mac, I'm like, yes, this is great. I'm actually going to play this stuff from time to time in the same. And you're exactly right. You play like one button and puzzle games and like color matching games on the phone through arcade. You can play more richer and deeper experiences on the TV, on the iPad, on newer iPads again, or, you know, on your actual like laptop or desktop computer. And I wish the arcade service would do a better job at recommending the right games to the right platforms, because it will still like recommend you Hot Lava on your phone, and you're never going to play that game on your phone and enjoy it. But you need like a bigger screen with a controller, and then you'll like it. And the Mac's a perfect destination for that.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And you know, my daughter is 6, so she does not have a Mac and doesn't need a Mac. But on her iPad 7, the $329 iPad 7, that is, you know, she watched me play on the iMac on Sunday night, and she wanted to play too. And that's what I realized. Oh, I had the Cell Series kind of terrible remote for the Apple TV, but it's the gaming controller that they recommended for the Apple TV. You know, I bought the test and then just never really used after that. For her, that's fine. And so we paired that to her iPad, and now that's her, like, her controller. And she knows that goes with her iPad. It belongs to her, and she can play her games with it. And even how to charge it, which is nice. And then for me, I've got the Xbox controller. And it's interesting. Like, I bought that over the weekend, and then as of this week, Apple stores now sell Xbox controllers. I don't think there's PlayStation yet, which is, you know, maybe they will in the future. But it's probably a bad place to buy an Xbox controller at the Apple Store because they're always cheaper on Amazon or even like other retailers, unless they price match for you. But I did wonder, like, maybe if they're doing Xbox first because it's confusing with Xbox whether your controller is Bluetooth or not, and then with PlayStation.
Yeah, because you have to get the newer generations.
Yeah, with PlayStation, it's pretty easy just to go and buy a controller, and then it works with it. So, but maybe they'll also have Sony PlayStation controllers in the future,
yeah,
too.
They'll stock PlayStation controllers eventually as well, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah. It's funny that we both have our preference, though, of you picked PS3 controller and I picked Xbox.
PS4 controller.
PS4 controller. So
I like the Xbox controller as well. Part of the reason I actually bought a PlayStation controller is because we have an Xbox in the house and we don't have a PlayStation anymore. So I kind of like, you know, got the variety in there, if that makes just to mix it up. One other thing I want to impress about Arcade is that it's $4.99 a month for six people across all of your Apple devices, right? If you buy these games on Steam, you're buying them to play on the computer only.
Yeah.
Like, you're going from, like, Hot Lava, right, is, I've just looked it up, is $20 on Steam. And obviously, you only have to buy it once and own it.
Yeah.
But if you add up, like, I've played Wild Hearts a little bit, I've played Hot Lava a little bit, I played What the Golf is a $20 game as well, by the way, on Steam. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for the one purchase, I've enjoyed those games across multiple platforms, across multiple devices, on the go. And like What the Golf is a great game that works well on the phone, and it works well on a bigger screen as well. Like, it really translates without having like device weirdness, and you can play it with a finger or you can play it with a mouse. It works great in all contexts. And if I'd have bought that on Steam and played it on my PC, I would have had to play it sitting down at my desk. But playing it through Arcade, you get Game Center Sync. I can play a level on my Mac if I want when I'm bored. I can then just go on the, you know, when I'm out and about, play it on my phone, play it on the TV, even if I really have to. Like, it's a really good value if you look at, even if you're just looking at pricing, not just experience, if that makes sense.
Mm, yeah. And as we're recording, Crossy Road Castle has a trailer out now that's coming to Arcade soon. So.
I played so much Crossy Road on my phone.
Uh-huh.
I'd be interested to see what their new game's like.
I've only ever played on the Apple TV. That was one of the games I actually did play with a controller on the Apple TV when the 4K box was, or actually when the 4th Gen box was new. So.
Oh, and actually this week, new for this episode of the show actually, is Apple Arcade released its first round of new games.
Mm-hmm.
So they're going to add new games every month. So they actually added four. And one that I think people should check out is called Pilgrims. It's like a little story adventure. It's quite short, but you can play it on your phone. And it's like a weird card game. It's hard to explain, but it's really, really good. It's called Pilgrim. So that's one of the four new games they added in October. So we're still waiting for them to actually hit their promised 100 game library.
Yeah, especially on the Mac, right?
Yeah, they're at like 76 at the moment, I think, on the phone. So they're getting there, and they still promise it'll be coming out in the coming weeks, so we'll be looking out for it. But just based on the new four they've added, the quality of titles is still really, really high.
Mm-hmm. And then there's lots of other new features in macOS Catalina. One is Sidecar, which is the feature where you can turn your iPad that's nearby on the same Wi-Fi network, I believe, and as a second display, whether it's mirroring what you have on your Mac or using it as a second display for extending your desktop and you know, putting Windows in. I've used this beyond testing like once in the past few weeks in a practical sense where it actually was really useful, because at my desk at home I use two monitors, and so I can easily fling a window over here and then just kind of observe that one and then work with these over here. I also have been working in like coffee shops lately just to try and get out of the house more and like during work hours. And so I use the MacBook Pro. It's 13 inches. I have the iPad Pro. It's 12.9 inches. Almost the same screen size there. And so I try it out using Sidecar, and I just put the iPad to the left of the MacBook Pro. Had my coffee, had my breakfast there, and you know, the keyboard on the MacBook Pro was the keyboard for the iPad, and the trackpad, you know, controlled the cursor. It was just like using a monitor out in the wild. I didn't worry about battery life because I had one thing charging at a time and kind of went back and forth. But that was really good experience. I wasn't taking up too much space at the table where I was. And it was actually useful. I was more productive then than I would have been without using the iPad as a second display.
Yeah, Sidecar's cool. I think it's one of those, like, niche features. It depends on you. It depends on your work environment, right? Like for me, my iPad stays indoors, and I work in the cabin outside, so it's not as nearby, right? So I'm. But there will be times when it'll be useful. Maybe especially when we do Apple events, it'd be nice just to have an external display I can flick up to use to put some Twitter feeds and stuff on there. But it kind of reminds me of like the. Remember they made a big deal about that feature a couple of years ago where it was like import from iPhone. You can like right click and import and quickly snap a picture on your phone. It immediately appears on the Mac.
I think it's cooler than that, but yes,
yeah. It's in that. I think for a lot of people it would be in that realm where it sounds something that sounds really interesting, but you end up just not using it because it's like you just rather use an actual native app on the iPad or a native app on the Mac. But yeah, so because it's good for the like what you said, like the observing experience where you kind of just like set the iPad up and you put Twitter feeds on it or something and you just leave it running.
And what I did was it was Slack and full screen on the iPad. And that's a lot of observation. Are people saying things that I need to respond to or not? But the big difference there is if you use a native app, you know, for something that you're going to interact with, then you will have that moment where, you know, unless you have a keyboard cover or a keyboard with you, then, you know, you want to type in. And so you've got the iPad like upright, hopefully. So it's like display, you know, level. Then you need to type on it. So you're touching the screen, you know, or you need to move something around. So you're touching the screen, having your hands already on your Mac keyboard and trackpad. It's just really natural, you know, and click and setting it up is just one click in the menu bar. So that's useful.
That's fair enough. Yeah. No, I think it is a good feature. Yeah.
I don't see myself ever using the 12-inch, you know, the 12.9-inch iPad with the 27-inch iMac, even if I didn't have the 21.5-inch second display. That's just too big of a difference in screen size that, you know, I'll just use the iPad on its own or I'll use the iMac on its own or with the other display. But when you've got screens that are very similar in size, like even the 11-inch iPad, then I think that's a level where if you're using a notebook, especially, it could be really practical, but it's just too different in size to use as like a third display next to the way, way bigger iMac, you know,
An interesting detail about Sidecar actually is that if apps update, they can get raw events from the Apple Pencil. So if you have like Photoshop or Affinity Photo and stuff that are updated to support Sidecar directly, when you touch on the screen with your pencil in those apps, the actual source app on the Mac gets raw pencil events. It doesn't get like an abstract touch event. It can get like all the force data and it can get the pressure data and it can get the tilt information. So you can actually use it as like a drawing stylus. And even to the point where they can get the you know, the double tap gesture where you change modes on the second generation pencil, that event can get sent to the actual Mac app. So even though the Mac doesn't have any pencil support of its own, it can like proxy it through the iPad directly, which is an interesting little angle. But then at the same time, it's like, well, you know, on one hand, Apple's advertising advertising Photoshop for the iPad, which supposedly is still coming very soon. Mm-hmm. It's like, well, wouldn't you just use the actual Photoshop on the iPad versus broadcasting the screen? But, you know, it's different situations and some workflows, it makes sense and others, it doesn't, not so much. Yeah, but it's nice to have and it seems to work pretty reliably.
Mm-hmm. The other thing, we now have screen time on the Mac for the first time. So this is the sort of, you know, half parental control, half kind of monitor your time spent, you know, on your own, on your screen. Have you tried using this on the Mac yet?
Yeah, I launched it. I still have problems with screen time on any of my devices where sometimes it doesn't have like some days of data. I don't get it. Like some days I just open screen time on any device and it would just be blank until like yesterday. And sometimes it works fine, sometimes it doesn't. So it's kind of wonky, but screen time on the Mac, it works, it's fine. It seems to coalesce apps together. So like if you use a TV on the iPhone, it will add in the TV on the Mac time. So it can actually join, you know, even though they're iOS and Mac apps, it can associate them with each other, which is nice. And realistically, if I want a fully representative display of my screen time in a week, that having the Mac there is a key component because, you know, I spend all my day working on the Mac and my screen time figures up to now were basically not very useful because it would discount 8 hours per day of me actually being, you know, looking at a screen. So just the fact that it's there now rounds out the experience, and hopefully by Sunday when they get the weekly report, I'll actually have data now that I feel like I can act on because it's actually accurate, if that makes sense.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I before now, I was surprised at just how high my screen time numbers were throughout the week when the phone wasn't the primary, you know, device I was using, because I use my phone throughout the day, even with being in front of a Mac. But yeah, I like the idea that now we can have the full picture, in theory of your, all of your Apple devices, even if, you know, you're not the only one saying it's a little bit rocky still, you know, whether it's on the iPhone or the Mac, you know, now. The Find My app, you know, we've had to reckon with that name. It's with us. The app, so the history here is that you used to have Find My Friends as a widget in the Today view, which is like the half of Notification Center. And so it's really hidden, but it can be useful, you know, to access there. And so it's whatever you set up from Find My Friends on the iPhone or iPad that gets put there. You can also do Find My Friends on iCloud.com. Now there is a single app. It doesn't have the widget aspect to it, so a feature is removed there for now. But they put, just like on the iPhone and the iPad, they put Find My Friends and then Find My iPhone and all your devices into a single app. And it's not a terrible app. I mean, for me, I've found it useful. I have it on the dock now. It's cool that it's in one app. You know, and obviously the big picture here is that it will eventually be the app that we use to track these beacons that we believe are coming, or not beacons, but you know, tracking devices or
the tag towers, whatever you want to call them.
Right. And so there'll be even more value then. And I've heard just on listening to different podcasts enough ideas of like what you'd do with one, like put one on your bicycle, put one in a backpack, those kind of things that I'm getting excited for those whenever they show up, if they show up. How are you feeling about the new Find My app on Catalina?
Yeah, it's kind of, again, this is a Catalyst app, which is, you know, interesting in its own. It's not an AppKit experience, but I do actually think it's, you know, very, very, very good for what it is. And it works well. The icon's nice. Unfortunately, offline fighting requires the T2 chip, because obviously if you get to Catalina and you have a T2 chip, your MacBook Pro will take part in the Find network as well, so it will do the Bluetooth beacon, so if an iPhone walks past and picks it up, it can find the device even if your laptop's no longer connected to the internet for whatever reason, like if you're in a coffee shop and you're not connected to their Wi-Fi, for instance. So if you're on Catalina with a T2 chip, you can take advantage of that. My 2016 MacBook Pro is not compatible with that, unfortunately, but that's kind of like the big news there for Find My, is that your Mac laptop, which is, if you lose it, right, it's going to be not connected to the internet because it doesn't have cellular or anything. Mm-hmm. You actually have a chance of finding it again now, because someone could walk past with an iOS device, find the Bluetooth beacon range, pick it up, and then send a message back to you eventually. Like,
and that's any
the power
Mac,
of the the power of the like the Find My ecosystem is just getting like stronger and stronger by the day, and it will be like multiplied again when they start selling the tags.
Yeah, and there's any MacBook Air that you can buy today, any MacBook Pro that you can buy today, and then also like some recent models before that, and then it's also the iMac Pro, and then the Mac Mini, no iMac non-Pro, right? And then, of course, not like the 12-inch MacBook that's gone now, and older, much older, like MacBook Pros and Airs, but a lot of the recent stuff has it. So that's neat. I mean, and just like looking at the app again right now in front of me, it's not just like being able to find your devices and like that, but also the Find My, you know, friends aspect of it. You can control, you know, like if you have alerts on for when someone arrives or leaves a location, you know, as you mutually share your location, then you can get those alerts on the Mac too, not just on the phone or on the iPad. So,
I'm doubting myself now, but Find My iPhone never had a Mac app, right? You had to go to the website.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's just a bonus for me, because everyone in my house is losing stuff and they always go to me to find it. They're like, they can't be bothered to go in the settings themselves, so I have to do it all the time.
I love the Siri feature.
I'm trying to train my family to use that. I'm like, you know, you can just ask Siri now, where's your X device, and it will actually get it. But they're just lazy and they just text me. Like, rather than ask Siri themselves, they'll text me in the other room, like, can you make my iPhone ping? I'm like, okay,
you are Siri in the equation.
Yeah, exactly. It's like a human Siri. It's putting me to work. But now I'm just happy that I actually have a native app for that. And it actually feels like truly native, it doesn't feel like a web browser experience like the TV app does. So, but, and then comparing that to what we had before, which was literally going to iCloud.com and clicking to find my iPhone, and that was always really slow and took ages. Having just a native icon for that is so useful for me.
Mm-hmm. And then there's this new, you know, this is a feature that Rambo had reported before it was announced as part of the OS, but the ability to use your Apple Watch to do more than just unlock your Mac or do Apple Pay transactions with your Mac, but you can also use it now in place of your password and in a lot of places where you have an alert on the watch, you double click the side button, and then you skip the process of using your password, which is really useful if you have a desktop or a notebook without Touch ID. And even with Touch ID, I mean, it's kind of cool to do the watch. It's not automatic. There's still some input required. And it's not every single place, right? Like, it's,
That's what's weird about this is like some dialogues will show you just enter your actual password. Some dialogues will show you can use Touch ID. And then some other dialogues, you can either use Touch ID or approve on the watch. Like, I wish they'd unify the authentication there. But yes, this kind of problem existed on its own with Touch ID alone. It was like, mm-hmm, some stuff you can use Touch ID for and some stuff you just have to enter your system password in. And now you kind of have like a third layer of that because there's also some stuff overlapping and intersecting that can also be approved on the watch. So it is a bit of a mess, but it's useful. I have a touch bar. So for me at the moment, my muscle memory is still to just move my finger to the button, but maybe over time it will become more useful for me to like double click my watch instead.
Yeah, if you're using your Mac in like a clamshell environment where it's attached, mm-hmm, to a display and you know it's closed and you're using your own mouse and keyboard. Let's see if we can talk about the latest stuff from Ming-Chi Kuo in 10 minutes or under. What do you think?
He's been on a bit of a roll.
I'll let you just walk through it all.
Yeah, so Kuo has pushed out a bajillion reports in the last like month or so, although most of them are covering two main topics. You've got the iPhone SE 2, which is what he's calling it, but it's essentially iPhone 8 body with an A13 processor, and then presumably going on sale early next year, early 2020, like first quarter time frame. It's definitely going towards that Apple believes the iPhone SE appeals because of price, not because of size, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's not keeping the 4-inch, it's not retaining the 4-inch form factor. It's moving up a notch to the 4.7-inch form factor, mm-hmm, keeping Touch ID, mostly looking like an iPhone 8, but adding, you know, a newer internals, newer processor, and it's going to be aimed at people that obviously are price conscious, but also if you think about who can update to iOS 13, the big group of people that are left out are iPhone 6 and iPhone 6 Plus devices. And as we all know, those were the most sold iPhones of all time by model. So there's a huge swell of the current iOS user base that is running iPhones that cannot update to 13, which means they can't get any of the new features and they can't take advantage of Apple Arcade or augmented reality stuff or any of that stuff. So the simple matter is, if Apple needs to be able to convince these people, you know, now's the year when you need to drop your iPhone 6 and actually get a new phone. And in addition to having a good high-end lineup, having a strong entry-level model, which mostly looks like your iPhone 6, except it's faster, right? Because an iPhone 8 still kind of looks like an iPhone 6. It still has Touch ID for people that are wary about, you know, switching to gestures or don't want to use Face ID. Having this in the lineup, especially, you know, just after iOS 13 drop support for this entire swath of, mm-hmm, of customers, it's a good strategic move, and it'll probably, you know, drive a lot of sales.
Yeah, you can make different trade-offs to hit a price point that makes it a better product than the 8 would in the lineup today.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And for people that are out there going, I just want a smaller phone, remember, we still have the rumors that the 2020 high-end iPhone will come in a new 5.4-inch screen size. Yeah. So that will actually be physically smaller than the current iPhone 11 Pro is. Yeah. So if you want really small phones, maybe that's where you're heading.
Some of those people have deep voices. They're like, I want a smaller phone. You know, so.
That's just my like general community complaint voice.
I know.
Yeah. Followed on from that, Kuo reiterated that the iPad Pro update, which includes triple cameras on the back and maybe like a 3D sensor on the back for augmented reality stuff, that is apparently not coming this year. That is coming again like first quarter next year. And then apparently the quarter after that, so like June timeframe of 2020, Apple is going to announce or release their AR headsets stuff. Now, Quo says these are AR headsets that will essentially be driven by an iPhone, basically in the same way that the first Apple Watch was driven by the iPhone. We're expecting the same kind of system here, but obviously with augmented reality glasses, where the iPhone renders the UI and just sends it wirelessly, it provides the data connection, etc., etc. Quo says that there will be multiple headsets, and they'll be made in partnership with third-party companies. So it doesn't sound like it's going to be the quote-unquote the Apple AR headset. It's going to be some kind of partnership, integration, collaboration thing. And I'm not sure how I feel about that. It's still hard to know for sure exactly what their rollout plan is here. But potentially, we could see them announce it soon. We saw the code references in iOS 13, the SDK, right? We've reported on that before. And if you look at other big projects that Apple has done in the past, other big hardware stuff, they announce them further out than, you know, year-over-year updates because they don't have anything to cannibalize. Mm-hmm. So there's an outside chance we could see the stereo AR headset thing be a part of, like, even the October event that we assume is going to happen at some point.
Yeah, we don't know about an October event yet, but as we record, but we certainly haven't rolled one out yet. Do you think the headset will work with my new Xbox controller?
If it does games, sure.
Microsoft will make one. They'll be in the Apple Store. This is all going together.
I mean, Microsoft make the HoloLens. Maybe it's just the iPhone works with the HoloLens.
Yeah, and where my Apple Store is, it's the Microsoft Store, like right across the aisle. Yeah,
that's going to be such a downer, though, if Apple's like big AR project is, oh, you know, all these headsets that everyone laughs at now and doesn't really use. Well, now the iPhone can work with them. I still hope that this is kind of like a stepping stone.
Yes,
this is like a beginning pathway for it, and then Apple's actually working on their own, because we don't even know if these stereo AR headsets are going to be like the gaming headsets, which kind of look like helmets, or if they're going to be, you know, sleek and thin like glasses, right? And for a while, there were big news about Apple's work on actual glasses, but just based on the current state of technology, it seems unlikely that they're coming this year, next year, even the year after, probably, just because of constraints of power, constraints of battery life, constraints of, you know, just visual design and aesthetics. So I think, if I had to guess, whatever's coming in 2020 is like, not the Motorola rocker of the iPhone, but on that kind of basis. It's like the first step integration. Maybe it integrates with Apple Arcade. Maybe there's some specific apps that you can play around with your phone. But, you know, really behind the scenes, Apple's still working on this is their hardware for AR on your face. But that's not what's coming in mid-2020.
Yeah. I mean, you remember the live talk show interview from John Gruber last year, and Greg Joswiak was part of it. Or it might have been the one before that. It was this year. But
yeah, the one with the AR lead, like Mike Rockman, I think his name is, something like that.
Rockwell.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then the whole thing was like, you know, you don't want to hold up there's a reference of like, you don't want to hold up your hand all day for a stylus for input or a touchscreen to like a touchscreen laptop. So why do you want to hold up an iPad all day for AR? And it's like, wouldn't it be better just to wear your face? And then there's like this big, like, you know, just wait kind of thing. But surely that will be there. Last thing I want to say this week is thank you to all of the Happy Hour listeners who help support my fundraiser for my local animal shelter. I mentioned, I think last week, that this ended sort of abruptly, where it was supposed to go through kind of mid-November after my half marathon run at Disney World next month. And they were closing down this feature of the service for crowdfunding for any campaign. And I had this month sooner deadline, and it made me nervous because I didn't know if I was going to be able to make my goal or not. And sure enough, I as we record, I'm at 103%. My goal was to raise $1,300 for my animal shelter. We're at $1,350 right now. This does close the day after we record, so by the time the episode's out, it's probably too late. But thank you to everyone who donated any amount of money. I really appreciate it. It's the first time I've ever done anything like this, and it just makes me so grateful for our audience because, you know, I chipped in a little bit, not a whole lot at all, and you did too, Mayo. I really appreciate that. But so much of this is from listeners I know. So thank you, everyone who donated there. With that being said, this is the Happy Hour podcast for this week. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Apollo Zach. Benjamin, you're on Twitter at
BZA Mayo.
And you can email us at happyhour@9to5mac.com. If you enjoy the show, give us a rating in Apple Podcasts or Overcast. If you are a new listener, welcome, and please subscribe so you can hear new episodes every week. And we will be back next week. Bye, everybody.